From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 790, responding to a ransomware attack with guest Dana Epp. Recorded Monday, July 19th, 2021. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. For his 17th interview here on Run As Radio, including show number 3, my friend Dana Epp, who is a serial entrepreneur who has founded several security-based software companies that have gone public or been sold through acquisition, and just did a .NET Rocks, which I think will come out before this Run As comes out, because I'm actually tend to be further ahead on Run As. Welcome back, friend.
Thank you, sir. How is life?
Too many shows. This is crazy how many shows you've done. I mean, I've only been making this show for 14 years. And, you know, and you've been on it, this will be 17 times. That's more than one a year.
Well, there's always a lot to talk about when it comes to security, right?
Oh my goodness, no kidding. You know, and definitely I realized looking at this, like there were waves. There were different levels of crisis. And this ransomware crisis, I'm bringing in some big guns to talk about this topic in different angles, just because I'm trying to figure out, is it actually worse or are we just talking about it more? Has it always been bad?
It's interesting. I think what's happening is we look at it from the perspective of crime. And at the end of the day, where's the money?
Yeah.
Criminals go where the money is. And I would say that if you looked even 10 years ago, it was much harder in the digital realm to be able to extract as much money as you can now. And that comes from two sides of it. It's the simplicity of attacks now. Like when I look at my offensive tradecraft work I do, you know, I look at what I'm capable of able to build and there and exploit. I see companies now that are literally creating C2 server software packages that
ransomware as a service.
Yeah, exactly. And like I look at that and just go, holy cow, because what ends up happening now is you don't need to be that sophisticated. You just need to have the right tooling. And the dark web makes that easy to purchase. And so what ends up happening is if you're in a place where one of the biggest problems with any kind of crime really comes down to is the legal side of it. How do you follow up? And when you're talking international, that becomes so hard.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is that these people have no morals or ethics behind them. So the aspect of, you know, flaming entire networks and hey, you might get one or two is more than enough for them because it's a foothold. And once you got the foothold, you have enough to drop something in there. And if that business gets to a point where they don't have good DR plans or BC plans. I think business continuity is a big problem.
It's the better thinking, without a doubt. And I do want to bring up, we're recording this middle of July for publication middle of August. And just these past few days, the R Evil folks have disappeared after that huge exploit.
Yep.
And so it doesn't matter if you pay the ransom. There's nowhere to pay the ransom to. All of their billing systems, the charging systems are gone.
Yeah,
I wonder if this is part of ransomware's gotten too big that now the big gun good guys are after them and they're being dismantled. But if you
they'll pop up again.
I wonder if they will. But if you're an IT guy who was caught in that R Evil exploit and all your stuff is mangled, like you don't get to make a choice now. There is nowhere to play the ransom. I hope you've got your business continuity in order because you need to rebuild.
Well, and the reality is that actually is how the attitude should be. I think at the end of the day, you know, the FBI has come out and said, don't pay the ransomware. Mm-hmm. Some people will because they don't think they have anything better to do. The biggest problem with ransomware these days is that no one cares about it. And let's just speak from an IR perspective until after it's hit. And that's too late. Like they need to be sitting back. My attitude is this, and this is on anything from dev security to IT security. It is assume breach. Mm-hmm. If we start looking at and thinking about, let's assume we get breached. What next? And this is part of the fun part of BC and DR is when you start thinking about things like incident response simulation, like doing tabletop reads and literally saying, okay, guys, let's just assume for a minute. you know, like if here where you and I are both in Western Canada, we have a ton of fires that are going on right now. Wildfires have literally wiped out entire towns.
Yep.
And I will bet you if you were to look back now and say, if you were a small business that was in that town, did you account for what would happen if your building was gone? Right. Probably not. Mm. Right. Like, it's just not practical to think about all these things. Just like back in 9/11, people weren't thinking about, you know, planes going through buildings. But at the end of the day, when you start thinking about what happens if my building's not there? What happens if my computers are no longer functioning? How does my business run? From a business continuity place, you start starting to think differently. And if you're thinking about disaster recovery, such as, okay, all of our servers and our laptops are burned down, what would we do?
Right.
If we start having that kind of attitude, when we start about cyber response, so cyber incident response, it actually starts becoming a little more, we're not having to panic. We're not having to go, oh, I got to go and pay this ransom.
Right, right.
No, okay. What are we going to do?
It can be a clinical thing. And I think there's some organizations that have gotten that point where it's like, hey, I've done the math for what it takes to do a scratch restore and the ransom is cheaper, which is cynical.
Yeah.
But that says more about you have made your recovery process too expensive.
Absolutely. And it comes down to, you know, size organization and what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, let's think about this for a second. Let's just assume for a moment someone got hit with ransomware. You know, mm-hmm. what's the first thing that's going in their head, right? And I'm pretty sure the first thing they're not thinking about is, okay, how do we isolate the infection? Because sure. they're probably not even thinking that far, right? And it's like, turn off the switches. Like, if you yeah. know something's happening on your network, turn off the switches. Yeah, like, let's just
take out the external connect, take out the internet, take off the network.
Yeah.
Isolate the machines.
Don't turn the machines off.
No.
Right? Because then the next question is, if you're not panicking and you're stopping, yes, employees are screaming right now. They can't do their work. But you're stopping for a moment and say, take a breath. Where are we? Mm-hmm. What's going on? Do we need to get people externally involved? Depending on the business, right?
Yeah.
Depending on the size and the compliance obligations they may have, there may be needs to get in touch with your lawyers so that they can start preparing for possible litigation. I work a lot with IT service providers.
Sure.
And, you know, they're working with tons of businesses that will probably end up looking at them and saying, what the hell, right? The other side of it is you got to worry about, you know, communication plans and what's going on if you have customers that may be impacted. If you're a bank or a credit union, as an example, and you're in the middle of this and you no longer can, you know, provide the support to give out the money you need to do because something's going on, you know, what's the plan? There has to be some.
Plus, that's a regulated industry. So right away, your regulators are involved.
Right.
But, and so, you know, it occurred to me, I shut off the switches. Now I don't have access to my InCaseOut file because it's on the file server. I mean,
right. Well, part of the plans has to account for how do you have out of band communications?
Right.
How do you get access in? Do you have SOPs printed out? So let's assume for a moment that we don't want to touch the computers. Do you have a binder with a standard operating procedure for incident response?
Right.
That should exist. Where is that? Does everyone know? And actually, I take a step back. Even before we're worrying about turning off the switches, the question is, do you have an IR team? Have you planned for this? Who's in charge? Who is the IR manager who is the person that's going to keep herding the cattle together, right? All these cats need to be figured out. What's going on? How's it going to be handled? Who is the senior executive or management in the organization that has to be contacted immediately so that the executive have a clear understanding something's going on and then be able to support the team as they go through it, right? You have your IT people because they need to be involved in there. And then, of course, anyone else that's your, you know, your team one, your first responder, so to speak.
Yeah, this sounds like this is the plan. It's on an encrypted USB key that's like the break glass key, independent of the network.
Yeah.
You know, you're able to get to that. And then it should have those list of names. Like now you do your call around.
Yeah, I repurposed one of our Surface Pros, and I turned it into an air gap system with all the networks turned off, everything that's on there, and my instant response plan for all that stuff is there.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And it has no privileges on the network anyway. There's no point in plugging in the network. Like,
not at all.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, in the response here is, and then I have that in safe and I just go in, I pull it out. The biggest risk I might have is like, I might have to power it up, right? Because
right.
it's been sitting in there for a while. I'm sure we'll handle power, but in the scenarios that we don't have that, we even have power stations to be able to, you know, the little 500 megawatt, you know, Blue Eddies sitting in the closet that can handle running a laptop for a period of time while we're trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
The idea there then at least gets you to a point of what's the plan and how do we deal with it? And it's not owned by one person. It's just not one person thing. You got to have multiple people because, hey, people go on vacation. People might you know, have their own issues to deal with. When you're thinking about business continuity, you know, we're talking here about ransomware, but this same plan should be able to work in case of a major flood or a fire. And then right. you got people issues where, hey, people might be worried that my family's house burned down. I'm not thinking about my business's IR strategy.
When it was one of the hurricanes where it was an online hurricane and people were worried about their families while shutting down data centers or going to backups and so forth. Like, that's an incredible conflict to deal with when you're talking about the scope of natural disaster, but this is ransomware.
Yeah.
The scope's a little calmer, but I do think it's never going to be the senior guy who pulls the cord on this that first detects it, right? This is a support ticket. What's this message? Right. The red screen. Yeah. One of them was a red screen. I think the Our Evil one was, you know, red text on a white background. But it's like, here's this screen. You've been encrypted. You know, here's how to pay your ransom. And it comes in as a support ticket.
Yeah.
And it's some
frontline support. First thing should be, if someone's reporting that to you, what is the plan? Okay, we hear that a machine has been ransomware infected. First thing you're doing is calling that person directly on cell phones or whatever.
Right. Get out of the company loop.
Get out of the way. Let's get this isolated as much as possible and then work backwards. Once the machine is isolated, then it's like, okay, what network are they connected to? What subnet? Like, depending on
the machine. And I like your response, don't turn the machine off. Unplug the network cable.
Right, absolutely. And the reason for that is, depending on your industry and your organization, there may be needs for forensic analysis. If you power it off, you could potentially lose any kind of evidence, especially if it's a foothold that's done in memory only.
Right.
As soon as you power it off, it's gone. And especially if you start talking about the roles you'll have for external bodies that, like, let's say insurance, right? If you've got a cyber insurance policy that has certain requirements of understanding what has originally occurred, if you just shut everything off, that's not always that easy. And you want to, sometimes, depending on the maturity of your organization, you may very well want to take an image of that machine in a state that then you can allow for forensic analysis afterwards. At the end of the day, the business people are going to say, I just want to get back to running business. And you need to be able to account for that, because, you know, businesses are there to make money. But by panicking and shutting things down and doing it, you may cause more damage than if you just isolated it and then gave it a moment.
Right.
You could always pull a new machine off the shelf, depending on how you provision in your workstations and machines, and get the person back up and running while leaving that machine isolated.
That machine's no longer their machine. It's now evidence, essentially.
Absolutely.
And evidence of a crime.
Right. Yeah. And that's clear. We got to make it very clear here. Anytime ransomware is hit in this regard, there is a crime that has occurred.
Yes.
How the business decides to respond to that crime, how you're going to deal with the impacts of that from a financial perspective, from a compliance perspective, depending on which country you're in. Some countries have a very well-established government agencies that want to be involved in this kind of stuff. Because if you're being hit, chances are other people being hit, and they're correlating that for a much bigger response to the attackers, especially when you're talking about threat actors that are purpose built for this type of stuff.
And we think about stuff like the SolarWinds and so forth, where it was a huge attack, and this seems to be more common, where you do absolutely want to participate in services that have that larger view, and it's good news for you because you're going to get more help.
Yes, absolutely. And you're not paying. Like, I think a lot of people feel when they first get hit that there's no help available.
Yeah.
And that's not always true. It depends on the country. You know, like, we're in Canada. We have our cybersecurity infrastructure in organizations at the government level, much different than in the US, as an example.
Right.
And so that's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's just what it is. And so the laws are different, but so too are how we're going to respond and manage it. At the end of the day, though, we're going back to the goal here is to get back. If we assume breach and we want to get our businesses back up and running, this all comes down to your business continuity plan and your disaster recovery plan, which goes down, backs to the point of, what's your backups like?
Right.
And I know you and I have had conversations, you know, outside of the show here, where we've been talking about a lot of this ransomware these days are even going so far as to, like, take out the backups.
Yeah.
Because, you know, their goal is not just to cause destruction on the working machines, but get into the backup systems themselves. Well,
they want you to pay the ransom. And so they're trying to make it, you at least feel you don't have an out.
Right. And what's interesting is there are, for most of the backup suppliers that are out there, especially on the digital ones, I'm not talking about tape here, but if we're talking about like ones that are backup storage devices and NASs and whatnot, they all have mechanisms for in-place, time-of-place backups and incrementals in a way so that even if they're ransomware, you can easily recover. Like, and that's very...
Then it's a question of how much data you have a backup. It's a question of how old is it?
Yeah.
How much data are you losing?
And how resilient. And so what ends up happening is it's one of those things where it's kind of interesting. Like even at my home network, I have, I have Synology technology that's there and as for some NASs and backing up all my VMs and my laptops and everything that's on there. But I have more ransomware protection on that NAS than anything else simply because that's my biggest target even at home, right? So like when I'm worrying about someone getting in through, my wireless and going through and trying to do some weird stuff that's on there, I know that even if that's ransomware, I'm only out an hour to 2 hours, depending on what's going on.
The risk is that you're running backups of encrypted data.
Part of the interesting scenario you get into is if you don't know you've been ransomware and hit, how far back could you have a polluted backup set?
Sure.
And so like I have backup sets, that I'm doing that's depending on which machines and what I'm trying to protect, things that are hourly, some that are daily and weekly and monthly. And I even have an annual one. And then they're all cross-checked and validated over a period of time. And the point of that is just that assumed breach mentality of, okay, how far can I handle for my business? And this all comes down to what I consider, your BIA, your business impact analysis, which is part of your BC, right? Is you should always be looking and saying, okay, what am I willing or what can I handle? And then you do that at the point of view from where is the data? Because information security is all about securing information. So it's not as much important about the machine itself. It's not about the hardware. It's more about the data that's on there that is being managed through the software. And so at the end of the day, it's like, what is the most important things I need to keep up and running? If Sally's machine goes offline and been hit with ransomware, what's the important data that's on there compared to Bob's machine? Does the CEO have more information that's probably more sensitive than the secretary in the front? What's important? So that when you start talking about ransomware hitting, especially if it's spidering across a network, you got to start prioritizing. And part of prioritization is about what's most likely to be of concern and what do we need to bring up first, right? What needs that immediate and proper response versus what can wait? Because you can't boil the ocean, you can't do everything.
No, there has to be a priority order. This is definitely a great part of the SOP is
right.
When I did my planning for the building has burned down, how to recover, early on was payroll, right? Core HR services, like stuff that the employees cannot function if this thing's not working.
Yep. And it's interesting when thinking about digital, when I think about that kind of stuff, I also think about not the digital, but the stuff that we don't ever think about. Everyone always thinks their stuff's the most important. It's just human nature. Mm-hmm. But how about things like, where's the checkbook? If the building burned down and you need to write a check to buy new hardware at the local computer store just to keep you going, do you have a few checks somewhere safe?
Or do you know who to call to get some printed in an emergency?
Exactly. That's great. And so those kind of things. And so start thinking about that in the digital divide as well, right? Like if you're ransomware and your machines are offline and you need to communicate with staff or external parties, how do you do that? Right? Like if your mail server is internal to the network and you're shutting down the network, you're not able to communicate to anyone directly. Do you have some sort of backup mechanism? Do you have some sort of push technology? Like we use Twilio here. So it's like in the case of emergency, we have a way to fire off to personal devices, but we never use that for normal business operations. No,
it's an
right?
emergency.
It's emergency. So the theory being is like, hey, you know what? If we've been ransomware and our machines, we can't communicate, how do we communicate with staff? How do we communicate with others? And I look at that from, I care more about my people than the process sometimes.
Yeah.
And so I just want to know, like in the case of, ransomware is a little different because we're talking about something a little more under digital control. But I always think from my BC perspective, I just want to make sure everyone's okay. Because if the place was burning down, how are you doing? Is your family safe? How do you communicate that if the core way, like if you can't use, if no one has the ability to communicate with each other, what are you going to do? What are those options? And it's not perfect because Twilio is going to send to cell service where cell service may be offline, depending where it is.
Right?
Like there's all these fallbacks. But these are things to be thinking about. And when you think about it from a ransomware perspective, it's the same concept. How do your staff communicate, especially on the online world? The pandemic has done one thing for us. It's made it awesome for us to be able to work more remote. But then you think and work the backwards from that. If you hit ransomware, now your machines are all locked down and unable to communicate. What is the strategy? What does staff know to do if all of a sudden they can't use their computer and they're working from home?
Do they have other computers?
Do they have other communication mechanisms? Can they get on the Teams? Can they get in Office 365? Like, what is that story? And how have they trained?
We got to talk about the cloud in this context. But first,
your users are working remotely and the bad guys know it. New phishing attacks are already landing in the inboxes of your users. Are those machines as protected as they would be if they were on-prem? If their machine catches ransomware, how fast can you get it fixed? Don't be the IT admin who could have done something but didn't. Block the badness and prevent business continuity problems at the source by using Policy Pack on your remote work Windows 10 machines. With Policy Pack, you get the power to manage applications and browsers on Windows 10, overcome application UAC prompts, block unknownware, dynamically configure the Windows 10 start screen, taskbar, and file associations. As a bonus, you can use Policy Pack to deliver any real on-prem group policy and group policy preferences settings to your remote work machines for the security and configuration they need. Learn how thousands of other admins enhance their remote work scenarios. Come to policypack.com/remotework to learn more. That's policypack.com/remotework. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And listeners to this podcast are eligible to win a free copy of the Cybex Wiley book entitled MDM, Fundamental Security in the Modern Desktop, using Intune, Autopilot, and Azure to manage, deploy, and secure Windows 10 by Jeremy Moskowitz, Enterprise Mobility MVP. Simply pick Run As Radio in the dropdown when you visit policypack.com/remotework. Good luck, and we hope you win.
And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. This is Dana Epp. And we were talking about this alternative communication mean. And you just keep we're kind of hinting at the cloud side of this because you don't get to down the cloud because of ransomware. Yeah. But you would presume.
Although, I don't know. With Windows 365, that could change, right?
Yeah, because so I think about OneDrive for Business and things like that. Like, I don't know. I haven't had any evidence. I don't know. Have you of a ransomware attack where they're actually encrypting those kinds of shares?
Ah, so yes, what's happening is it's happening local. So think about OneDrive for Business, right? Or I'm a big fan of with Teams, having the ability to install the Teams connector. So then all your files that are in your Teams channels end up being synced with your local machine. Well, that local machine will be encrypted. And so that file is ransomware and it's syncing. So guess what? It can sync back up into Teams, into the cloud, which could affect other users. However, there are strong defenses. The Microsoft's endpoint components, especially in Defender, which is in the cloud, has components to scan and monitor and alert you on that behavior as it's happening. And of course, more important than anything else is even if it is encrypted, there's backups and their point in time backs allow you to snapshot back immediately.
Right.
So you can be able to see and convert. So even if that does happen, yes, it got infected on that, you know, that Surface Book at home. And yes, it synced it up and maybe possibly got it into the cloud, but there are always copies of it. There's a history to that and you can recover from that. And more importantly, as it's getting up into the cloud, it's being scanned and validated. And the maturity of the security ops stuff that's going on in the cloud are probably much more mature than what you'll have on premise in many cases.
Which begs the question, should we be, are we more protected from ransomware if we're all in M365? Like, is this an answer?
Well, for many ways, because think about things that you can assume for a moment that your on-prem infrastructure is down, it's unavailable, mm-hmm. everything that's there. The ability to walk to your local computer store, you know, your Best Buys of the world or whatnot, and be able just to pick up a machine and easily cloud join that to get back online, or maybe not even cloud joining, just being able to take your iPad and get on, you know, the ability to have the identity and access management solution that Microsoft has in the Microsoft Cloud and being able to bridge that from almost any device. Yes, there should be, you know, multi-factor authentication, other components that are on there to help you join it in a safe way, but it allows you to get back so then you're able to communicate and hopefully be able to continue to do your job because a lot of that stuff's hosted in the cloud in a different way.
Right.
That's quite helpful. It can be. And I think that with the world of the cloud joins now and the more mature way of deployment manager and how you can then have the apps you need brought back down, it gets to a point where you're almost at a throwaway endpoints. I look at Windows as a desktop. It's kind of interesting because I know I may tick off some of my Microsoft friends, but I think the way that Microsoft restructured its own business units and the way that the world is now today, Windows is nothing more than just another edge device to the cloud.
Yeah.
And because of that, if you treat it that way, as powerful as it is, don't get me wrong, Windows is amazing, and a lot of the capabilities and everything that's got on there, when it's merged together in this hybrid solution where you can have these edge devices anywhere in the world joining into the cloud and then taking advantage of that identity and access backplane to then access all the applications that you can and should be using in the cloud as part of your business, it becomes immediately powerful, immediately valuable. If you then merge that with your business apps that you have, because every business has their own way of doing things, some of that can't run in the cloud, or if it runs in the cloud, it's done differently.
Right.
Well, that's where Azure is so powerful, because now you have, with private networks and the ability to run the VMs, and you can start getting to a point of having a hybrid world where even if you have on-premise workloads and need to stay there, a majority of that can be backed up or managed and be able to be recovered in the cloud.
Yeah.
So now if you have infrastructure like Hyper-V running in your own organization and you have backups that allow you, you can spin those images up into Azure if you need to. Yes, there's a delay, but when we're talking about meantime to recovery, part of the business contingency planning and DR preparedness should be, can I get these back up on other infrastructure, be that on-prem or in the cloud, so that that outage period is not as long as it may be if you're trying to actually physically recover everything on-premise.
Well, this is where you get into stuff like Azure Backup, where my on-premise VMs are backed up to the cloud and can be restored in the cloud. You know, you're even talking about going to the Best Buys and the other shops to buy gear. And it's like, wait, if I can just use cloud gear for those services, even though I wasn't initially migrated to the cloud, that might be my fastest up.
And that's your way. And I think this is where we see the future of like Windows 11 and, you know, Windows 365 is you can spin those desktops into the cloud. It's a virtual desktop running in the cloud, running your entire workload in a safe manner.
Right.
And if you have those conclaves in a way that they're secured and you can know the identity of the people accessing it, now you get into this hybrid world. Now, it does mean you have to have internet. So depending on the condition of what's going on, ransomware, not usually a problem with the internet going down.
Right.
But if we're talking about things like fires going through buildings, you know, you may not have the internet to do what you need to do. But you'll be able to find it. The local Starbucks is going to give you ability to, you know, hobble in and get work done.
Get some stuff then, going anyway. Yeah.
Right. And you can take your iPad Pro that you have at home that you use and temporarily use that to connect to your virtual desktop in the cloud. Right. And so now you're running Windows 365 running on your iPad. And that's stuff coming this fall.
That's pretty powerful. Yeah. But I'm also now thinking that initial step, the you down the switches. Now I think I'd unplug everything from the switch and bring the switch back up and then bring in only the things because the internet's not infected. It's the machines. So keeping the machines off the network and then only bringing into the network that which you know is clean and you know have access to your internet connection. Like I'm starting to get a feel for the rebuild now.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny as you're thinking about it, and this comes down to if you're not panicking and you have a plan, the first thing, the reason you go to the switch and turn it off is that's one command. One SNMP command can turn off that switch and no one's available. And then you can say, okay, now I want to light up one by one. Now, if you don't have a managed switch, you don't have the capability, you might run in there and start unplugging. The hell of trying to remembering which one to plug back in, it all comes down to, you know, how well your data center, your...
Yeah, or do you have smart switches where you could have turned off all those ports and then bring them up gradually?
Right, and then bring them up one by one, right? So if we've isolated that infection and we know which machines are there, part of the problem is we don't usually know because when we're first there, we're panicking, trying to figure out, well, what's going on. Turning everything off is just a temporary way of saying, okay, take a breath. Let's see where we're at. Slowly bring up. And this goes back down to that reprioritization. If we know this.
Right. And getting the right people involved in the loop and then starting to prosecute through this piece by piece.
That's right. And now you can start bringing it back up in there and say, okay, oh, I see that Billy is a developer. He's working from home. He has not been touched because he's even been on the VPN. He can continue to function in the work he needs. But, you know, Joe over there, he's in the manufacturing side of the business and we don't know where we're at with him. We're going to have to decide how important that is right now. Can that be down right now? Where the CEO is like, got to communicate with everybody.
Yeah. This is a triage now of
absolutely
what's known safe, what's known bad, what's unknown.
Yeah. And every business is going to have their own way. This is like when it comes to security and we talk about risk mitigation, everyone's risk tolerance, risk levels, and more importantly, what they're willing to consider at risk is going to differ. And so there's no, you can't buy a piece of software that's going to handle this. There's no single template that's going to do this. This requires the manual sitting down, thinking about, this is where I think the table reads, like they call them, sometimes they call them like tabletop exercises or incident response simulation. It's the aspect of just getting all the key stakeholders together in a room and sit down and say, okay, let's assume for a moment the building burned down. Who do we contact first? What has to happen? Right. Where's going on? And when you start talking like that and you're assuming breach or you're assuming destruction, now all of a sudden you're talking, okay, who do we talk to? Who do we go to? Where do we do? How would you do that? And now you start poking holes at the plan and start trying to figure out way before there's an issue what to do. And then you practice it, right? Yeah. As much best as you can to make sure, do these technologies work? Have we tested our backups? Have we tested the communications plan? Have do the right people?
Yeah.
What do we do with that person? Who is the second in command to our communication strategy, right? If you have a PR firm you're having to deal with, if you're a major entity that has exposure, you know, or do you have a communication plan to your staff? Like all that stuff is all got to be kind of ironed out. And that should be in that SOP, which is, you know, it's air gapped. It's printed separately. It's available so that in the worst case scenario, we have the ability to follow through. But then you test it. And when you test it, that's when you start finding all the things you're not thinking about.
Yeah.
Like the check one. I thought about that one time when we were going through an exercise and we're like, okay, and then we're going to send out and just buy new replacement laptops at the local Future Shop, which is our local computer store, was that had been acquired.
Right.
And I was like, and they're like, okay, but who's paying for that?
Yeah.
And I'm like,
How
are we paying for that? And it's like, okay, so where's the credit card to make that available and accessible, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, who's got that? Where is that located? Is that located offsite? Okay, if that's not available, what's our backup? How do we make sure we can account for that? Because we're not going to go and send one of our junior staff to go to the store and put it on his credit card. That's not appropriate. That's not right. But we need a plan. And so those type of things you don't deal with until you start thinking that way.
I like the power that it gives you. If you're prepared to go from smoking a hole in the ground to operational, ransomware is not that dramatic anymore.
No, it's not. And then it's just part of the same plan, right? Your BCDR plan becomes the same way. If it's ransomware, if it's a building burning down, or it's a plane going through it, what are your plans and how do you handle it? And then when you have that tornado or hurricane that comes through, or you have that fire that hits you, you're in a place where you're not panicking and you have a reasonable way of how can the business stay functioning. And when you combine that with your BIA, right, that whole business impact analysis is how long can we be offline before the business is materially impacted? What is our cost? It also has a much more meaningful conversation from the IT side of what are we investing in? Because a lot of times people are like, well, we can't afford this again. And say, okay, can you afford not to? If we were to have the place burned down and we don't have backups that are out up in the cloud, if we're not investing in the cloud infrastructure to support this and from a BC perspective, what will that impact be? Now, some businesses will say, hey, you know what? We can be offline for 3-4 days, right? Like, that's fine. Okay, cool. And if you're not, what is that business loss? How much of that? Now, all of a sudden, when you start talking about investing in your IT, you start having the ability to look at it from an OPEX or CAPEX perspective. You start looking at it differently. And now, all of a sudden, IT usually can get a little more resources when they start realizing just how critical it is at the business.
What do you see as a typical recovery time for ransomware? Whether you pay it or restore, like,
well, I think that it's going to be dependent on the size and impact of it. If we're talking that only a few machines got hit, that's entirely different than if the entire network of a multi-site conglomerate has been infected. It is entirely different.
Well, and we see these scope of attacks where they were actually in the system for months.
Yeah.
And staging.
And they give them the foothold, they stage everything, and then they whip it. And then once they hit it, then it's there, right? So the way I would look at that is, what is your mean time to recovery of an asset? So let's just say a single PC, right? And you say, and then scale that to the number of PCs that have been affected. Because don't forget, if all of a sudden you have, let's say you have 50 machines that need to all be imaged or restored at the same time, your limit's going to be your network more than it's going to, and your people's time to be able to do that, right? Like, you know, this is where I like things like MDT and the ability of having the deployment toolkit in my Microsoft. And when you do, and combine that with things like cloud join when it's when possible, you have the ability. Restoration in some cases is it's quicker and cheaper to just buy a new machine and join it and let it rerun and sync up all the stuff.
Right.
And then take a look at, okay, now for the critical businesses, people that need it, they have that response. And that may just simply be a couple of, you know, Microsoft Surfaces sitting in boxes in the back room, unless, of course, you got a fire and place is gone.
The building's gone. Right. But, you know, that's a few hours. You know, I've seen recovery times of a couple of weeks. And I bring that up because when you have business owners that are like, no, no, we can't afford to lose a day of business. It's like, this day of business is done. And probably this week of business is done. Now start thinking, you know, whoever you need to call to deal with that is one thing. You know, the continuity insurance and things like that. But I do think it helps to just sort of set that, which isn't going to end in an hour. Like, get your head around. No.
The technical side's different than the human side. And I think part of the thing that really harms when cases of ransomware and everything else is you don't know everything that's been impacted and hit. And there's time involved to go look that up.
Right. To get to scope.
And to research, get to a point of confidence of being able to be restored. Because here's an example of a scenario. I can't mention the company, but I recently had a conversation with someone when we were related to recovery where they did everything right. They had the right plans, everything that was in there, but they had one gaping hole. And that was in recovery. They didn't account for the fact that the ransomware may have taken out their backups.
Right.
And so what they did is they went, did everything. They decided to wipe and replace, and then they restored from backup, which had the ransomware on there. And guess what it did?
It repropagated. As soon as
it repropagated and did it again. And then they're like, oh! And then they're like, okay. So part of the problem is being able to know when you do recovery, how do you get to a known good state? What is a known good state?
What resources are still known good? Like, how do you inspect backups to say, have these been infected?
Well, and you don't know, because if they're staging, some of these ransomware people now are putting in rats into the system, like remote access Trojans and whatnot, it just gives them enough of a foothold. So even if you cleared out all the ransomware, but the rat is still there, when they restore and that rat's there, then they just get back in. They got the foothold and they start all over again. And so part of the problem, or it's not really a problem, but it's just a way to, how do you plan to prevent the recurrence is really starting to understand, okay, once we know. So the good news is, a lot of these threat actors and their TTPs that they use, they have a very clear footprint. And so once you know
what the attack was,
you can start working backwards, because now you can look for indicators of compromise. And there's tons of threat hunting organizations out there that can help to provide you with, if you're hit with the Reval stuff as an example,
right,
here is what the indicators of compromise are. Here's how you can look for and detect if those are in your backups, right? So you can look and say, okay, I think we're in a clean state at this point, and we have ways to validate that. And this is where you come down to, it may take a week or two. It's like, maybe you're going to take your time and say, okay, let's recover one machine and keep it isolated from the network. And now let's do our validations of indicators of compromise based on what we know here. What else can we look for? And then once you're at a place where you have the confidence to say, okay, I've got a clean image, I've got a clean capability, that's user one, right? And now you can start looking and saying, because that will help you to be able to see how far back you
need
to go. This
is now, I see, you know, the power of the table read is educating the business owners of this is what it takes to recover from this attack, and why you should plan for a week to be down, and why we should have more resources. How do you feel about cybersecurity insurance? Ransomware insurance, so to speak.
Well, I've been hearing more and more horror stories of people that are paying into it, and then when it's time to actually get money back, it's not helping. And at the end of the day, and I'm not saying you shouldn't invest in insurance. It is one of those keystones that allows you to understand your risk and understand balancing it. Some businesses I've actually heard, especially in ones that are focused on compliance and obligations, where it's just cheaper to buy the cyber insurance than to actually properly invest in your IT. And that's a sad reality. And I
just wonder if that's actually true. I mean, it's certainly cheaper until the attack comes.
Right. And then now, because ransomware is becoming so much more prevalent, the problem you start getting into is all the professionals like the IR specialists and your lawyers and your insurance providers are so backed up that even trying to get your claims handled and managed and get that, that's not going to help your business today.
No.
Right.
So that's more downtime.
Exactly. And so I'm not saying you shouldn't invest in the insurance providers that are going to provide those services, but understand what they're willing to cover, what the process is, because you're going to need to know that anyways, because they're going to probably want lots of information like, okay, how did it happen? What was your process for response? How was it? Did you pay the ransomware or not? Some of them won't allow, don't want you to do that.
Right.
And so understanding what they need as part of the coverage on the policy, and then what are you covering and what are you protecting? What are you dealing with? Because sometimes I think people just jump and say, hey, I got a line item that's going to tell me that I have cybersecurity insurance, but does that cover third-party liability? Does it cover data and information that may be related to your customers, right? Like, what do you do in the case of, a breach?
This is now a whole data theft conversation above and beyond the encryption conversation.
Right. And now it's like, and if you're having to pay for their credit monitoring services and all these other things, like there's just a tons of other components that are involved in there. And so I think there's different stages of what needs to be looked at when you're talking about the investment. And that's not, when I think about like who's listening on Rana's radio and that, they don't typically have all the responsibilities that executive team needs to be accounting for and thinking about in all this. And this is more than just IT, right? There is a ton of, and if you think about it, when I'm talking about business continuity planning and disaster recovery, IT is critical and involved in those things.
But they're not making all the decisions there. No.
No.
But I think that's part of the problem here is that often the organization thinks, well, if we just pay the ransom, the problem will go away.
Well, first off, can you trust the criminals that have hit you first off? That's the first thing. Secondly, if they go offline, like we saw with Revel and Revel,
you may not be able to pay.
You may not be able to
pay. I did a show with Paula not that long ago where the decryptor didn't work properly. And like a quarter of the data did not get decrypted. And she actually was able to ultimately fix the decryptor to recover that data. But I just think it's not only that paying the ransom is bad ethics and bad for the industry, but it often doesn't fix the problem.
No.
And you're still vulnerable.
Right. And at the end of the day, all you've done is potentially recovered some files.
Maybe.
But if you assumed breach and had them properly backed up, you could have got those files and it would have cost you nothing than the time there. I think when we think about disaster recovery, it really comes down to what your BCR solution is. And your backup and recovery is a critical component. And it should be more than just, we have a copy of it. Elsewhere.
Like
it's got to be more than that. And there are tons of solutions that are out there that work out extremely well, where they have a hardware solution plus a cloud solution with syncing and capabilities of managing and handling those type of scenarios.
And setting those backups cold so they can't be overwritten.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's where I think things like Azure are very powerful, because the cost of cold storage, right? When you're thinking about mechanisms for storing and locking away data for periods of time that can't be touched and managed and maintained separately is very powerful, because then it's like you're not worrying about active intrusion and you've got these. But the problem you get depending on your business is what does cold storage look like, and from a snapshotting point of view, right? And how far back do you go, and what are you protecting? You don't need to back up everything. Like, I think one of the things I've always thought was scary is the concept of, we just back up all our laptops completely using Microsoft backup to our NAS. And it's just like, okay, first off, that's a waste of storage, because like you don't need to back up the Windows binaries. Like you just don't, right? Yeah. Like there are ways of what is important on the machines. Like when I think about information security, I push so hard on people. It's the information.
Yeah.
I honestly don't give a damn about the operating system.
Yeah, we can get another copy of that any day of the week.
About the software.
Yeah.
But what I care about is what that software produces and manages. Mm-hmm. I care about the configuration of that software so I understand how to get it to recovery. And this is why I love so much things like infrastructure as code, right? Because I think IAC gives us this capability to say, I don't care. I can take it from my repo and restore it with a single, hopefully automated command to get us to a point where we need to. I think that's the same with operating systems when I think of things like MDT and the capabilities of pushing and getting us to a good known state. And automating all that stuff.
Right.
One of my favorite stories I heard many years ago was about the world of Home Depot.
Right.
And how their IT infrastructure works. They have like very few IT people. And all they do is they work with their manufacturers. And back in the day, it was Dell. You basically make an order in Dell. Dell has the boot P components all set up so that it can pixie boot. And when it comes up, it connects to a central server that just says, I want to image it to this. What is this? So this is the paint department.
Right.
It turns on the paint department, and it's there. And then they make sure they maintain that central server at each store with images on there, with the expectation that any day, if something goes wrong, they just wipe and replace it. And it's all done remote. All they do is they get some person who's on the floor, who might be the person that's greeting you. They just say, plug it in. And when you do that, menu's going to pop up and you're just going to click on X. And so that anyone can do that restore, and right. They have that assumption. And those type of attitudes years and years ago has served them well as they scale their organizations and their businesses and then to deal with that kind of stuff of restoration. It just becomes part of a process that anyone can do. It's easy in there. And then IT knows exactly what that set is going to look like. When something goes wrong, they can upload and wipe and replace and just keep going.
It's a great conversation to say, how mature is your restoration process? Not your backup process. How mature is your restoration process?
And how frequently do you test it?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter how good your backups are, if at the end of the day, it's not done right, or you missed a key component or that. And that's, I know it's hard sometimes, but some of the vendors that are out there now help, they actually have services to help you to say, we're going to do a full restoration test. So they can help you isolate and verify and do that. So when you have a cloud solution, you can say, so like in the world of Microsoft and with Azure backup and everything, you have the capability very easily to spin up a VM to see if it runs, keep it isolated on a separate private network to see, did it come up properly? Does it have everything we need? Is it there? And are we routinely validating that so that when the panic comes in, when that ransomware hits, you're like, how quickly can we get to a restoration point of view to get certain business operations running while we continue to evaluate and investigate what's going on so that the business can function to some degree?
Yeah, I wonder if there isn't some more services Microsoft could provide in that area. I love the idea of like taking an on-prem VM and firing it up into a ransomware detection container on the cloud, where it's very strictly controlling how it can communicate outward, and you can light it up and look at it. And have it help you understand. This one looks clean. This is good. You could probably turn this machine on.
Azure ransomware simulator.
Right.
You know,
something like, along this line.
I wouldn't be surprised if they have capabilities internally for that stuff. Yeah. I'm not so they'd want to expose that. But you know, it's one of those things. I think when you sit back at the end of the day and we talk about ransomware, I think if we stop panicking and fretting so much about the offensive tradecraft and start thinking defensively about in our business continuity planning, how do we keep the business running? And what is our disaster recovery plan when it comes to restoration?
Yeah.
Now we can say we have capabilities. We're not going to get it all right. That's just the reality of it all. But if you don't panic and you have a plan, it becomes something where we can get the business back up and running. And if your mean time to recovery for the entire business is a week, you're in a pretty good state because most businesses can handle managing their clients in a week, right? If you can have critical operations up in a few hours, then you're in a good state to keep communication. I think the biggest thing I see that goes terribly wrong is usually not being able to communicate to staff, not being able to communicate to customers and do so in a safe manner that anyone can trust.
I think it's a great task to build up this sort of amber alert side of your business to communicate out of band. I'm sure that smartphones are the way. Most of your employees are going to have those. And as long as you're maintaining that phone list well, like this seems like a really good service just to have for all business continuity related stuff.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. That's one of the reasons I like Twilio so much. That's not personal bias to me. So, you know, you take it with a grain of salt. I don't get sponsored by them. I pay them. They don't pay me.
Right.
But what I love about that service is there's so many different components to it and so many API capabilities. So it's easy for us to shunt it. So I have a Logic app that's literally designed to do trigger off into Twilio to be able to message out as I need to. And then what I've got on top of that is that my user base, I do have it's not a requirement, but I highly recommend that they provide us with their mobile number into Azure Active Directory. And I have that in a isolated way so that, you know, they're not sharing their mobile number with everybody, but we have that in the system.
But you can also do that extraction and maintain a list of those numbers separate from the main system.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it seems really clever.
And then as we onboard and offboard staff, then we know, because we don't want to be alerting X employees that were having an issue. So having the ability to offboard that, then it says, hey, we're looking for active employees that are in the tenant that have the information. Now Twilio can fire off a message. We can tell them, at least get them some information that's on there. And we have a way to reach our people whenever we need to.
Awesome stuff. Hey, Dana, really fun. I mean, as much as you said, plan and be careful, this seemed like a very energetic show. There's a lot. Well, it's a lot that happens during a crisis like this.
Yeah. Attitude should be assumed breach. If we start looking at it that way, we do the tabletop thinking and the planning and the exercises that way, we'll find the holes, we'll be able to figure out what's going on, and then we don't have to panic when it happens. Yeah. But this all means
have a written plan
about it beforehand.
So the people that are
listening to this right now, who because they just got hit, sorry, I can't help you. It's too late.
But it's
one of those things where I think, you know, don't panic.
I've also been in the firefight where the written plan saved our bacon because you're not thinking clearly during a crisis. It doesn't matter how much you practice. At the moment you're under stress, the written plan will save your bacon every time.
And the thing is, we're human, and we're stressed. At high points of stress, there has to be a plan that can be easily followed. Yeah. And everyone involved, if we know who all the stakeholders are, we know who's responsible for what, we know where we need to get to, even when we make mistakes, we're there to support each other. We know who's responsible for what. We can help them out. As a team, we can make it and get through it. What's funny is externally, people won't know. They won't see it. They can easily go and, you know, think the worst. But while you're focused on just getting response done, you're in a place to get you back up and running, and then you can move on.
Thank you, man. It was really a great conversation. I hope it helps some folks. We, you know, the ransomware situation is far from over, and there's more shows to come, but great view of how we can respond to this.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.